Hey, folks. Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. So the idea behind the podcast is simple. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. Blood was everywhere. I walked into a room and I felt like I'd entered into a horror movie, only this was my life. There, seated on the floor, was my daughter with a razor blade in her hand, cutting her arms as if she were casually slicing a piece of meat. I could see other scars on her legs and thighs. Tears were streaming down her face. When she saw me, she had an absolute meltdown. Exaggerated story? Not really. This scenario describes what clinicians have come to know as self-injurious behavior, or cutting. Statistics show that between 12 and 24% of the secondary school and young adult population have self-injured, while between 6 and 8% of this population report to current and chronic self-injury. Self-injury has been on the rise for several years and covers a wide range of behaviors and motivations. And as perplexing as this disorder is, we'll find out today from my guest, Scott Koningsberg, what would cause anyone to willingly harm themselves in this way. Scott is a licensed professional counselor and has worked in the mental health profession for the past 20 years. He has experience working with patients in a wide range of treatment settings, including outpatient, day treatment, home-based, inpatient, and residential. Scott has been working with self-injurious patients at Virginia's Dominion Hospital Self-Injurious Behavior Track for the past 7 years and the Dual Diagnosis Track for the past 8 years. He has been instrumental in implementing the dynamic Self-Injurious Behavior Treatment Track and working to stay current with this difficult and ever-changing population. In addition, he's spoken publicly in many forums on the stressors related to the adolescent population in our society today. Scott, welcome to Heartline.
Thank you.
I understand we have Amy Kokolin with us also today.
Yes.
Okay, guys. Start us out with explaining to our audience, what is self-injury?
Well, we like to use a couple different definitions for self-injury. One being that the act of attempting to alter a mood state by intentionally inflicting physical harm that's serious enough to cause tissue damage to one's body. And then the other being that there's a deliberate mutilation of the body or a body part, not with the intent to commit suicide, but as a way of trying to manage emotions that might be too painful for them to express with words.
Hmm. What isn't self-injury?
Well, you know, people a lot of times misunderstand self-injury, so I think it is a good question about what is not considered self-injurious behavior. The definitions that we kind of rule out for non-self-injurious behavior is when the primary purpose is for a few different other reasons. Usually, it's for body decoration or beautification, such as piercing or tattooing, and the primary purpose is not to relieve any kind of emotional anxiety. Some people also do it for sexual gratification or a form of spiritual enlightenment through ritualistic purposes. And then we also have a lot of adolescents that try and do it with the intention of trying to fit in with their peer population and perceive to be cool by their peers.
Yeah, I've actually treated this population myself, and I find out that people are having these little cutting groups that they belong to and doing this together. Is that what you're finding?
Yes, but a lot of the kids that end up in our self-injurious group, they're very private about it. And that's one of the things I think that's a misnomer that people have is that, you know, people want to be out there and that they're trying to intentionally seek attention from other people by self-injuring. But for a lot of self-injurers, it's a very private matter and they go to great lengths to cover up and hide their scars. But some do, you know, look at their scars as a form of history, you know, and each scar kind of tells a tale of a difficult time of their lives when they just couldn't cope with the emotions that they were dealing with. They felt overwhelmed, so self-injury became a coping skill for them to use. And we talk about it like that in the groups. It is a coping skill, but we consider it to be a self-destructive coping skill. And so our goal is to try and help teach them more productive coping skills to use instead.
Can you explain to folks how this cutting actually helps to relieve anxiety? I mean, I know it actually, you know, does endorphins and all that stuff, releases endorphins. Mm-hmm. So how does this actually work?
Well, like you said, endorphin release, or some people even have like a dopamine release, which are natural things. You know, you go on a roller coaster and you get that same kind of endorphin release, that excitement, that adrenaline that's surging through your body. So a lot of people, when they maybe feel very emotionally numb a lot of the time, tell me that they use self-injury as a way to regain feeling again because they just don't have that emotion there, and so cutting or self-injuring becomes a way of them regaining some sense of feeling again. But a lot of people use self-injury as a way to deal with the emotional chaos that may be going on in their lives, and so when things feel otherwise out of control, you know, self-injury becomes the one thing that they feel like they have control over, so they use that as a way to sort of temporarily regain control. The problem with that being is that the feeling that, you know, gives them relief only lasts for a short period of time usually. It could be a matter of minutes or maybe even hours, but then they might start feeling anxious or depressed again, and thus the cycle tends to continue.
So does this go along with other disorders? I know it's prevalent with eating disorders, depressive disorders, anything else?
Yeah, there's not in the diagnostic and statistical manual that we use in the field of psychiatry and psychology, there's not an actual diagnosis for self-injurious behavior, and we talk to the people in the group about that here. It's more a symptom of usually a larger illness. Most of the people that we have in our groups are dealing with some type of mood disorder, whether it's major depression or bipolar disorder, and they're having mood swings. Some people can actively be psychotic or have what we now call dissociative identity disorder that was formerly called multiple personality disorder. A lot of people have anxiety disorders, just have a difficult time managing stress in their lives. And then for some people, and we don't usually diagnose this in adolescence, usually it doesn't come along till adulthood, but character personality traits, and the most common one that we diagnose with that would be a borderline personality, which the primary symptom is having a difficulty in relationships with other people.
So is how the anxiety is dissipated by the act of cutting, is it distracting the person then from whatever is going on and that calms the anxiety?
Yeah, I think for some people it can be a distraction, a temporary distraction from what's causing them emotional pain in their lives. Like you said before, for some it causes a relief from the anxiety or the stress or the depression that they're feeling. Amy, I don't know if you have any other thoughts about that.
I think the one thing that always comes to mind when someone asks me about that is a young woman who shared with me that the reason that she cuts is because she has pain in her heart that she can't touch.
Mm-hmm.
And she can't nurse it. She doesn't know what to do about it. So she creates a cut or injures herself somewhere, and she can watch it and help it to heal.
Wow.
It's her way of controlling that, and you know, while she is engaged in the act, that is her focus. That, you know, that's all she's doing. A lot of times you have individuals who are self-injuring and they are prepared. They have what they need to harm themselves and to take care of their wounds. So it really is kind of that control and having a way that they can understand to release that emotion and then heal from it.
So it's almost a maladaptive way of self-soothing.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Is this disorder gender specific? I mean, do you find that it's mostly girls that are doing this?
No, I think historically there's been a lot of, you know, studies that have suggested that there are a lot of white middle class women who are above average intelligence who may have started cutting in adolescence, but you know, we certainly treat a lot of adolescents with this issue and adults as well, but we find that it really cuts across all, you know, genders, races, cultures, all those kind of things. And we are finding, you know, there are more and more young men out there that tend to self-injure. I think that one of the things between the genders that sometimes gets crossed up is that there are boys out there that in general, not all boys, but tend to do more maybe violent or aggressive types of behavior, especially with the media out there and some of these shows where it's kind of perceived to be cool to do these daring and dangerous acts like jumping off of buildings and things like that, which may be some form of a self-injurious behavior if that's the intent behind it. But oftentimes, you know, they're doing that with the perception of trying to be perceived as fitting in with their peers or doing something cool. It tends to get diagnosed more in women, but we are experiencing a lot more young men that are dealing with the issue as well. And the problem really becomes when people tend to carry it in from their adolescenthood. When they start younger, they tend to stay at it, much like other addictive kind of behaviors, and tend to go into it, you know, carry it into their adulthood.
So do you classify this as an addiction?
Well, that's a good question. It's a tricky one, too. We don't. We differentiate this, how we differentiate this between other types of addictive. We talk about the fact that there's an addictive quality to it, and mm-hmm. for some people, like Amy said, it becomes very ritualistic when they're experiencing this emotional pain. They have a plan. They have, you know, their weapon of self-destruction handy. They also have ways of cleaning up themselves afterwards. But where we differentiate it from other types of addictive behaviors, such as substance abuse, eating disorders. Some people, though, refer to self-injury as the new anorexia, quote-unquote. But what we say is that whereas what we know about addictive behaviors is that people generally, there's some genetic predisposition there, and so it may be biologically predisposed. As far as we know right now, there's no biological predisposition to self-injurious behavior. It's more of a learned behavior, and so we teach them that it's a choice that they've made once they've started to self-injure, and it's a choice that they can make to stop, and that it can be something that they can put behind them if they're willing to learn alternative, more productive coping skills in the future.
And so what are some of the things that you teach them practically to do this?
Well, we have a lot of different techniques that we use here in the program. Some of the groups we do are more didactic in nature. We're teaching them how to get in touch with their thoughts, how to be more in touch with their feelings. A lot of times, they don't think about their thoughts and their feelings. They're just thinking, I'm in pain, so I self-injure. So we try and create that window of opportunity so that when they are having an urge or desire to want to self-injure, they'll stop and start to think about some of their feelings and the thoughts that they're having and what's creating that urge to want to self-injure. We also use a number of expressive therapies here in the group. My colleague Jody Wager does some expressive therapies with the kids once a week where they may do things like yoga or meditation or mindful, you know, techniques that can get them to be more in touch with their body. We use art therapy as a form of expression because a lot of times kids will tell me, you know, I just don't feel comfortable sitting down and talking about this all day long every day. I'd rather express it in other ways. Another technique that I use once a week is an improvisational theater-based technique. It's from the Brazilian artist Augusto Boal, and it's called The Theater of the Oppressed. And so we use improvisational theater as a way of getting them up and getting them active and doing things like role-playing and creating sculptures with the group and really getting more in touch with their thoughts and feelings.
Awesome. And so how about de-stressing techniques, things that will help to calm them or de-stress them, listening to music, maybe taking a hot bath,
yeah, definitely.
Going for a run, you know.
Yeah, we try and help them create those kind of lists of what we call coping skills while they're here so that they can extrapolate those into their real world when they get out of the hospital setting. And like you said, you know, listening to music is a big one. I actually play music in a lot of groups while the kids are working on other activities because it does help to soothe them a little bit. I think there's some misnomers out there, too, even in our profession about some techniques that others think may work that we don't tend to feel, you know, would be a positive thing to do. For example, putting a rubber band on your arm and snapping it on your wrist when you have an urge to self-injure.
Yeah, I've heard that.
If you do that enough, you know, you're going to create a welt, and that's a form of self-injurious behavior in and of itself. I've heard of some people using, like, a red magic marker and drawing on their arm to simulate the blood flowing down their arm, or cracking an egg on their arm to simulate the flow of the blood coming out of their body. But we discourage those kind of things here, and we try and encourage them to do other things, like you said, take a shower, take a walk, talk with somebody when you have an urge before you have the need to go and self-injure.
Yeah, and you know, I teach my clients that at any point in this cycle, you can make a different choice. Like if you go to cut yourself, you can recognize that in the moment and choose to do something different. You can choose to go to one of your more adaptive coping skills, like
Absolutely.
Go for a run or listen to the music or take a hot bath or whatever it is that they've come up with. So I think sometimes people feel, I know with the eating disorders, oh, well, I've eaten, you know, 4 cookies. I might as well just eat the whole bag. Well, no, you can choose in the moment to say, no, I'm going to do something different here. And I think that's a victory.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the things, unfortunately, we only have people usually in our program for a week or two on average, and then we're turning them back to their outpatient providers in the community. And so I think it's so important that outpatient clinicians are aware of these techniques as well. One of the things that we also do, a lot of the things that we've adapted into our program are based on things from Karen Quintero and Wendy Lader, and they have a book called Bodily Harm. And one of the things that I like in their book that I usually encourage people to do when they get back to their outpatient therapist is there's a series of writing assignments that they can work on. And when I've done this in an outpatient setting, I've usually given people a writing assignment each week. They go home and kind of work on it for homework, and then they come back and we kind of process it together.
Great. Amy, how about you jumping in on this one? Why do you think we're seeing more people self-injure in today's society? What sociocultural influences are contributing to this for kids?
Oh, that's more of a Scott question.
You're
talking clinical there.
Okay.
You know, one thing I did want to interject, though, with about the coping skills conversation is one of the things that I think is very beneficial when an individual is setting up their coping skills and identifying their coping skills is really to set an amount of time that they're going to, at the minimum, try these coping skills. Because when someone does have an urge to self-injure, and it has become ritualistic, it's something they have found to work for them, that's going to be what they're going to want to go to.
Mm-hmm.
And that these coping skills are not necessarily going to give them the same feeling or the same relief that self-injuring may give. So I think what we have seen in the acute care side is that some individuals may set up what we call a safety plan of coping skills, but they don't get as detailed as they may have needed to. You know, they turn on the radio and they don't like the song, so they turn it off. Or, you know, they can't decide whether they want a cold shower or a hot shower. You know, really saying, okay, I'm going to get detailed on those coping skills and say, I'm going to have a hot shower and I'm going to be in there for at least X amount of time.
Great point.
I'm going to listen to this type of music. You know, maybe a certain type of music really makes a certain emotion worse. You know, if you're angry, maybe you shouldn't listen to angry music as your coping skill. So really identifying the type of music and how long you're going to listen to it before you move on to that next coping skill. Because the urge isn't necessarily going to subside just because you've done something different. You know, you really need to give yourself time, because what we have found is that urges peak. They peak and they valley. So
it's like the whole idea of exposure and response prevention that we use with people with OCD and stuff. Yeah, if you can hold out for that 20 to 30 minute window, the urge will kind of subside.
Correct.
Great. Scott, will you jump in on the question? Why are we seeing so much with these kids today in terms of this kind of behavior?
Well, I think you've got, you know, this immediate gratification society that we live in nowadays, where people want to fulfill, you know, if I have an urge, I need to get rid, especially if it's an uncomfortable one, I need to find some way to get rid of it immediately. And so, and I think this is, unfortunately, what we see sometimes, depending on certain cultures, it may not be perceived as something that the parents really understand what's going on. Although I have to say, across all cultures, I think parents, and generally when they first find out that their children may be self-injuring, they tend to go into this panic mode. And so what we try and teach the families is to try not to panic, to try to listen and accept and hear what they're saying and understand what their children are saying about the need to do that. You got to remember, a lot of these people may have come from a background where they may have been victims of abuse, they may have low self-esteem, they may have trouble relating to other people in intimate relationships, have difficulty articulating their thoughts and feelings, or have this insatiable need to be loved and accepted, or they may feel so badly about themselves that they feel like they're such a bad person who deserves to be self-injuring, and that's when you see some of the more extreme forms of it. But people are looking for the quick fix out there, and so unfortunately, self-injury becomes something that they may have accidentally stumbled on the first time when they've done it, and hey, wow, I got this sense of relief all of a sudden. Maybe I should try that again. And unfortunately, then it becomes a repetitive cycle for some people.
Well, what about the kid who's upper middle class family, booking along pretty well, maybe feels like she's a little too fat, but has a good home? I see some of those kinds of kids cutting.
Yeah, that's true, and they do. And usually, well, frequently, what's behind some of those things is they may have a parent in the home who may be a little bit rigid, you know, as far as, or they've quashed emotions that the kids were trying to express, or maybe if you have a more intrusive, hovering type of caretaker who may be overly critical or scrutinize everything the kid does. A lot of times we get kids that feel like they have to achieve this state of perfection in terms of their academic excellence or their social atmosphere, and so they feel like they can't meet the
expectations
mm-hmm. exactly that either, and it's not always parents setting those expectations. A lot of times it's the kids putting those expectations on themselves or to compete with others in this area. It's such a very competitive area across all kinds of things. I used to find it more that it was in the athletics and things, but, you know, my kids are involved in things such as theater and stuff, and even those areas are competitive nowadays. And so, you know, it's just one of these kind of things where you feel like you have to be the best out there, and if you're not, kids oftentimes end up feeling like they're not good enough. And then adults carry this stuff over too. You know, if they've been victims of things in the past and have unresolved issues that they haven't worked through therapeutically, then they still feel like they're less than they should be or where they should be at that point in their lives.
What about parents? What do they need to look for? Are there signs for this? If your kid's depressed a little bit, or what do they need to be looking for?
Yeah, oftentimes, you know, depression and anxiety, things like that, it's really hard because a lot of these things typically accompany the period of adolescenthood. You know, frequently self-injurers will go to great lengths to cover up their self-injurious scars. So a lot of people, kids will say that they're, you know, wearing long sleeves in the summertime or pants, and but some unfortunately get even more creative and depending on the season and know that they're wearing clothes that are more, you know, revealing more parts of their body, like their upper arms or their legs, will gravitate towards self-injuring in their middle torso of the body, the parts that may still be even covered up in the summertime. So I think, you know, if they tend to be isolating away more, tend to not be expressing their emotions as regularly as maybe they were at one point, if they find any kind of paraphernalia in and around the house, that can be a concern too. You know, we talk with parents, though, that if somebody is truly intent on self-injuring, you can try and get rid of every sharp item in the house that's available to them, but if they really want to find a way to do it, they will. So I think the big thing is just being able to sit down and talk to your kids and help, you know, get an idea of what they're thinking and how they're feeling, so that they don't feel like they have to go through this alone.
Absolutely. What are some of the things you're finding that kids are using to self-injure?
Oh, goodness. They go through all kinds of things. I mean, obviously, there's things like straight razors are probably the more common thing. Kids will take razors out of a parent's box cutters or things like that. Girls use the razors that they may shave their legs with in the shower. You know, we've had people use pencils or screwdrivers or tools around the house, kitchen knives. It could be something as simple as just using even their fingernails. And obviously, what are you going to do there? I mean, you know, but if somebody's got long fingernails and they're doing deep and heavy scratching on their arms, unfortunately, a lot of people who self-injure to create wounds on their body will not allow the wounds to heal. And so they'll pick at the scabs and not, you know, re-injure the parts that they've already injured. And so that becomes difficult, especially when you're talking about everyday household items that they can easily get a hold of.
Mm-hmm. So parents need to not freak out.
Right.
And they need to spend time just maybe listening. Is there anything else they can do? Because I'm sure that you see a lot of people freaking out, like you said.
Yeah, we do. And so I think, you know, educating themselves about, you know, self-injurious behavior. I mean, we still find that it's a relatively small portion of the population that does it, but that's not of any solace when it's your own child that's doing it. So I think, you know, parents can educate themselves on things. There's lots of good books out there. Like I said, Bodily Harm is one that I recommend to a lot of people. There are, you know, places that they can look at on the internet too about self-injurious behavior so that they can really understand what it is and what it isn't. I think a common misnomer is that a lot of people feel that self-injurers are attempting suicide, and for the large portion of them, that is not the case. That doesn't mean that they might not have suicidal thoughts at times, but oftentimes they're self-injuring just because they have such difficulty expressing emotional pain, and they're not necessarily intending to try and kill themselves. Not to say that that couldn't accidentally happen, and in rare cases it does, but for the most part, most people who are self-injuring are doing it to take care of the palliative aim, you know, getting physical calming and trying to get connecting between their mind and body and feeling cleansed from the emotional toxins that they're experiencing inside.
Do you think parents get that?
No, I don't think they do.
There's
and so
a fear
I think,
for them.
That, yeah, so yeah. That you have to. Parents have to understand that there's this analgesic or palliative aim that physically calms the body down when they maybe otherwise feel out of control. And also look at the communicative aims that they're trying to, what are the wishes or needs or desires that the self-injurer is trying to communicate either with themselves or to other people through their self-injurious acts.
So you'd recommend counseling. If parents out there are finding their kids are cutting, good counselor?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, and there's still, unfortunately, I think somewhat of a social stigma against counseling, I think more particularly for the males than the females. And definitely counseling is a great way to get into it and start talking openly with a therapist that they feel that they can connect with. And then hopefully, you know, that things can be dealt with on an outpatient level. And should they ever need inpatient or acute care, you know, places like us are available.
Right. So how can people get a hold of you guys to get more information if that's the case?
Amy, I'm going to let you take that one.
Well, most definitely. For more information, we do have a website, which is www.dominionhospital.com. And actually, there's a lot of information on there about all sorts of psychiatric illnesses, including self-injury. And as well, we have a first step department, which is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it's staffed by mental health nurses and licensed professionals. They can be reached at 703-538-2872. And what that conversation would be about would be just to talk about what's going on with the individual or perhaps a child if it's a parent calling, and to assess the need for level of care, whether we need to refer out to a outpatient provider or whether we think the individual needs to come in for a face-to-face assessment because they may need a higher level of care than outpatient.
Mm. Great resources. You guys, Amy, Scott, thank you so much for being our guests today on Heartline. I really appreciate your time and blessings and all the work you're doing over there at Dominion Hospital.
Thank you, Rita. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at siftedaswheat.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.